Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Read the plan. My plan cannot be defined on a tweet. It's defined by picking up the document and reading it.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And there was Mayor Adams asking all New Yorkers to read his 15-page blueprint to end gun violence. And now we wrap up our reading project, where we've been inviting you to do just that. We will take your calls and read your tweets with your questions and comments about what you've seen in the blueprint, both the intervention and prevention parts of ending gun violence, at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a tweet with the hashtag #ReadTheBlueprint. For our part, we will parse the blueprint with you, the parts that are controversial among Republicans, the parts that are controversial among Democrats, the many parts that have a broad consensus if they can find the money. The mayor announced his budget proposals yesterday. We'll relate the two. We know there are controversies like bail reform and lowering the age for some teenagers to be charged as adults for gun possession, and the new anti-gun units not in full uniform, and random screening for guns on passengers arriving at the Port Authority bus terminal. And there are points of pretty broad consensus, like more summer jobs for young New Yorkers, scaling up the community-based violence intervention programs, and expanding mental health services. Does the balance look like it will actually reduce gun violence? Does it look like it will avoid new rounds of mass incarceration and police abuse? We have three guests with different kinds of opinions and expertise who have read the blueprint to compare notes as we take your calls and tweets. Richard Aborn, president of the Citizens Crime Commission of New York City, a think tank that says it was founded in 1978, the bad old days, by concerned members of the business community to develop ideas that address crime and protect the economic and social viability of New York City. Antonin Pierre, leader of Communities United for Police Reform, which describes itself as a campaign to end discriminatory and abusive policing and promote public safety, relying less on the police. Antonin Pierre is also executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, a community organizing group based in Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. And Elise White, deputy research director at the Center for Court Innovation, which says it works to create a fair, effective, and humane justice system by performing original research and helping launch reforms around the world. Elise and Richard and Antonin, thanks so much for coming on together for this. Welcome to WNYC today.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be with you.
And again, listeners, if you read the blueprint to end gun violence, call with your comments or questions at 212-433-WNYC or tweet with the hashtag #ReadTheBlueprint. So as a premise, the blueprint says truly ending the crisis of gun violence will require both intervention and prevention. So let me go around the room and get each of your basic takes for about a minute apiece on how much you think the mayor gets the balance about right. Richard, I'll let you go first, as I think the most supportive of the mayor's balance of proposals.
Yeah, I think the mayor is pretty close to getting this right. I don't see these as a choice between interdicting and enforcing the law and prevention intervention. They need to all go side by side. We clearly have to get this gun crisis under control. Too many people are dying. But we do have to do it in a balanced way, and we have to do it in a way where we also apply prevention techniques. If we do those in tandem, and they are perfectly compatible with one another, in fact, we've been doing it for years in New York, then I think we can start getting ahead of this crisis. Once we get the gun violence back down, we can start shifting more towards the intervention prevention space, which is where ultimately we should be. But yeah, I think the mayor has got this right.
Antonin, same question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where the blueprint really, really goes wrong is trying to juxtapose the solutions that advocates have been asking for, like expanding SYP and the Fair Futures Initiative.
SYP is Summer Youth Program. Yep.
Great. Thank you. You know, we do this alphabet soup in nonprofits sometimes. But where it really goes wrong is juxtaposing these really important reforms that we actually need to be incredibly widespread. We actually need to put resources into communities that are facing issues with gun violence, because we know that gun violence is not just an isolated violence that's happening in a context of structural violence. And so when you're giving us these solutions in small amounts, and then you're giving us these wide wholesale expansions of the NYPD scope and power and influence in higher amounts, it really calls the question, what is the point, right? Is the point just to expand policing and say that we're increasing resources? Because if we do really want to increase resources, then it's really clear that policing is not effective in driving down gun violence. I think if it had been, then we wouldn't be in this moment that we're in now.
Elise, same question. And by the way, listeners, to Antonin's point right there, later in the segment, we'll get to the mayor's budget proposal released yesterday for the next fiscal year and see if in his first budget blueprint, he puts his money where his mouth is on the end gun violence blueprint on some of the non-policing as well as policing aspects. But at least same question on how much you think he gets the balance about right on paper.
So when I give my response is going to be based on qualitative and quantitative interviews that myself and some of my colleagues have done with about 400 young people who are gun carriers or who have carried guns in the last 4 or 5 years. So what we learned from them is that absolutely they're looking for employment opportunities. Absolutely they need and seek out mental health care, and that credible messengers are very powerful mechanisms to connecting young people to these things. And so I think on that front, the data that we have absolutely supports what the mayor has put forward. Now, I think where our work diverges a little bit is that increased police presence, I can't speak, and my data doesn't really talk to whether it's effective at driving down, gun crime. But what it does show us is that young people really respond and need and crave de-escalation support, safe spaces, and methods of bringing the temperature down. Because the more that they feel surveilled, the more they feel at threat and at risk, the more they carry guns. And that risk can come from other young people who are gun carriers, but it also comes from the police. And they're very clear on that, that the police also are driving their gun-carrying behavior. I would also say that, a lot of times what they'll talk about is, yes, police, more police on the street. I think about it, I'm aware of it, but it's not necessarily a deterrent for me because I'd rather be in jail than dead. So they're looking, their gun-carrying behavior, we know this, is driven by fear of their own death and the fear, for their family members. And those are real, real concerns that I don't think more employment opportunities and more mental health services really directly address.
Wow. What would?
Oh, well, I think, they need, as Antonin suggested, I think really robust programming on the ground, embedded in communities, because the conditions change, right? Neighborhood to neighborhood, the dynamics that are driving gun crime, whether it's gang related, even if we say that, which not all of it is, those dynamics are very different neighborhood by neighborhood. So it needs to be embedded in communities. I think that we've learned that gang leadership, we talk about credible messengers, and oftentimes that's euphemism for people who are gang involved, who have been gang involved. I think we need to get explicit that gang leadership is very powerful for young people who are gun carriers, both in helping to support them, helping them survive, and helping them, basically gatekeeping or approving what they're allowed to talk about outside of what is a very insular community for necessity and survival sake, right? So gang leadership really needs to be able to be brought to the table and to be engaged in conversations so that young people feel that they have the approval and the safety because often in their world, gang leadership and you know, these more powerful men within the gangs are those who secure the safety for the neighborhood.
Well, let's use that as a jumping off point for some discussion. And I think this is not the thing that most of the media has been focusing so much on. But you and Antonin both brought up the summer youth program in your first answers, but in very different ways. So, Antonin, let me go right back to you on this as somebody who said right away, summer jobs for youth is one of the most important things that you do support in the blueprint. And the mayor announced 100,000 jobs yesterday, funding for 100,000 jobs in the budget plan. But Elise just said, and I read in some of her literature too, that support for expanding summer job slots only matters if these young people who experience incredibly high exposure to violence and trauma have support for a transition into more traditional work environments, and that just saying summer youth employment kind of misses the point. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it would be really hard to not acknowledge that this is a step in the right direction, especially when SYP has not been baseline in the past, and there have been campaigns going back decades on just trying to get this one thing. But I really have to agree with Elise here. It's only part of the issue, and we do want to congratulate folks when they are moving a step in the right direction, but it's definitely not far enough. I think in the blueprint in particular, we see conflicting messages, right? So we see an expansion of SYP, and I just want to also name that we're talking about a massive expansion without a lot of detail about what that's going to look like infrastructurally for all the sites that are going to have to add new jobs. But then there's also an attack on New York State's Raise the Age law. And so it recommends that 16 and 17-year-olds facing gun charges be tried in criminal court rather than family court. So what we're hearing Mayor Adams say here is that, yes, young people need support, but they don't need too much support. And that kind of messaging really doesn't actually help move folks forward, move young people and communities forward in the way that Elise is talking. Because what young people need is, yes, these summer jobs, they also need development programs throughout the year. We're talking about, if you are a young person and you're helping to pay your family's rent on SYP, then there are a lot of other huge problems happening in your home, in your community, that are actually not being addressed just by having summer youth employment.
So here's another clip, Richard Ayborn, of the mayor on this show after he said he would expand city-funded summer jobs. Listen.
We are crunching the numbers now. I'm meeting every day with OMB, my Office of Management and Budget. But we're also asking our corporate leaders to do the same. 100% paid internship program for every child that wants a job.
100% paid internship program for every child that wants a job. So the numbers that the mayor released yesterday were 100,000 city-funded summer jobs, but in the blueprint, it says 250,000 who need summer jobs. And Richard, your group was founded by members of the business community, so I'm curious if you see the commitment to expand summer youth employment to that bigger number, to approach the total 250,000, including 150,000 who would not be covered by the city's program, per the mayor's number and suggestion there.
Yes, I do. Absolutely. At the Crime Commission, we have created and now run a job skill training program and jobs placement program for people who are gang involved. These are kids who face some of the biggest challenges in our city and live in some of the most challenged neighborhoods. And we're finding enormous receptivity in the business community to accepting some of these young folks into jobs. Sometimes they're internships. Sometimes they start out as apprenticeships, but the goal is to not get them into summer jobs. The goal is to get them into permanent jobs that have an horizon, not just a very short-term, low-level position, but rather someplace where they can start developing a career so we can help them understand that life can be more rewarding and see a longer-term expansion and horizon into life. So, yeah, I think the commitment is there, and as I said in the beginning, I think we should resist the temptation to say it's one or the other. To me, it's a false binary. To me, we need to be doing all these things. Gun violence is an extraordinarily complex phenomenon, and it requires a whole of government, and we should talk about that at some point, and in fact, a whole of society approach. The greater community in New York has to understand that we all have a role to play in reducing this. I do think there is, though, as I said, an immediacy to this, and I do think we're going to need police interventions to try and bring down some of the immediate shootings that are taking place. We're talking about summer employment. Summer is still months and months away. We need to get a handle on these shootings now, but to make the obvious point, we need to do it in a way that is not violative of the Constitution, as stop and frisk was, that does not expose people to unnecessary dangers, and is done under extraordinarily close supervision. But New York has a long history of bringing gun violence down. I mean, this is not, unfortunately, it's not the first time we've been in this predicament. I think if we combine the proactive police response, again, done in a careful, supervised way, and I'm well aware of the issues that have taken place in the past and have spoken out against them. If we combine that with proper prevention and intervention of the type that we're talking about now, we can start to make some real progress. There's an interesting paradox here, Brian. I'm quite familiar with the CCI report. It's a fantastic piece of research.
That's Elisa's report at the Center for Court Information, Court Innovation. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it. In fact, I intend to reach out to them and ask them to build on some pieces of it, because I think there's some more questions that they can be asking in the next round that they're doing now. And it is quite clear that people, the young people, are saying they're carrying guns because of fear. I think it's the CCI report, maybe it's another one, that also says the age at which people are first picking up guns is getting lower and lower, and we're seeing both in the research and hearing anecdotally that 12 and 13-year-olds are starting to pick up guns. So the paradox is this. If young kids are picking up guns because they're scared, unless we take away that fear, unless we provide more security to their neighborhoods, which everybody in those neighborhoods is entitled to, they're going to continue to pick up guns. And I don't see a short-term way of doing that with summer jobs. They are incredibly important. I'm fully supportive of them. But the problem is literally right now. I mean, right now people are being shot. And that, to me, is the urgency of this issue.
And as we go in our next segment, we'll talk about these neighborhood modified uniform anti-gun teams that the mayor wants to start releasing in neighborhoods, I guess, in a matter of days now. He said a few weeks ago it would be a few weeks. So I think those are coming to selected neighborhoods. And I know there's disagreement on this panel among whether that is a good idea. We will get to that. But let me take a few of our first callers, and starting with Wendy in Springfield, New Jersey. Wendy, hi, you're on WNYC. You say you read the blueprint, huh?
Oh, yes. I'm going to be looking at page 6 and page 11. As I've told you in another call, I was born and raised in Harlem. My mother tried, this was in the 70s, to help a young man. And this was, he was 12 or 13. He was definitely under 14. So, yes, even then, it was getting younger and younger. And she went to agencies, and they said, well, you have to be 14 and have already committed a crime. She brought him up to college, where I was. The fellows played basketball with him and talked to him. He went into crime. He was a bright person. He was in advanced classes, and even he ended up in crime. I hope now he's turned his life around. But my point is, 16 is too late. And I agree with what you've said about the summer programs. You need something that starts in the schools, getting people activated and interested in something, photography, filmmaking, the arts, so that the street doesn't win. And the second thing, now this thing about having the 16-year-old who has been chosen by the gang people to carry the gun because they're younger, and now you're going to say, well, if you don't tell us who gave you the gun, we're going to put you try you as an adult. Well, and this is a point that I didn't think of. I thought of Fifth Amendment rights. But on Radio Gag, the public advocate and the co-founder of Gays Against Guns were talking, and mm-hmm. the co-founder said, look, this is just like what happened with the drugs. The person who's at the lowest level is the one who gets the pressure. So once that person is now tried as a juvenile, everybody knows, okay, the person gave up the name. We're going to get him. We're going to get his family. So look what you've done. You've put them at risk. right? Don't do this. Find another way to do it. Don't start with the person at the lowest end of the chain and put pressure on them, on this 16-year-old who you haven't helped enough so that they couldn't, you know, get away from this problem. So
Wendy,
don't
thank
do
you.
This.
Thank you for all that. And Richard Aborn, I'm going to go right back to you on this, because when you emphasize the need to not wait for summer jobs programs and to intervene on the streets right now to get shootings down right now, is that one of the things that you have in mind, that proposal that's in the blueprint that's been very controversial, that would lower the age to be charged as an adult for illegal gun possession from 18 to 16, if the mayor says that person will not give up whoever supplied him with the gun? The theory from the mayor is that there are older gang members using younger teens as safe places, safe people with whom to stash their guns, because the law exempts them from adult penalties right now. And so the mayor says, okay, 16 and 17-year-olds, if you're caught with those guns and you won't give up who gave it to you, the name, then we're going to charge you as an adult. You hear the objection to that. Do you support that?
So to be very honest, Brian, and just to be open about this, I have very mixed feelings about this. You and I have talked about in the past, raise the age. I think, as you know, I was one of the early proponents of the raise the age proposal. When I ran for DA, I pushed hard on RTA, and I think it was a good law. The problem is this. We have an extraordinary problem with guns. And somebody who has received a gun or bought a gun on the streets from someone else is in a position to help us get other guns off the street. There's a long tradition in law enforcement of giving people more lenient sentences or more lenient treatment if they help identify other criminality. On the other hand, I'm worried that these are 16-year-olds, and if they do give up the source of the gun, not only is that a complicated thing for them to decide to do, but more immediately and more importantly, they may be subjecting themselves to retaliation. And I think we need to be conscious of that. So I have difficulty with this idea, though I fully understand the motivation behind it. The other piece of this that we have to discuss is while these conversations tend quite properly to focus on people who are caught up in crime and understand why they are there and what we can do as a society to try and prevent that from happening, not only as an intervention, in other words, against the immediate act, but also as a tool of prevention, helping them never get into that lifestyle, is a conversation that we have to continue. But we also need to understand that innocent people are being shot and killed, and we all know the litany of people who have been shot and killed by these illegal guns. So we need to understand both sides of this, both the offender side and trying to do whatever we can to prevent that person from reoffending, but also do absolutely whatever we can to protect innocent victims out there and to try and restore some stability in some of these communities.
All right. It sounds like nobody on this panel is in favor of re-lowering the age to 16 to be charged as an adult for some illegal gun possession charges. We'll continue in a minute with the results of our reading project, Reading Mayor Adams' Blueprint to End Gun Violence. Stay with us.
There's a feeling of sadness because I lost two amazing young people that were police officers, Officer Amara and Rivera. And, you know, you never want to see violence in the city where 11-month-old babies are shot sitting next to their mothers. And the six officers who were shot and the countless number of others. And so there's a sadness whenever I respond to these incidents. But my life has been responding to incidents and crises and bringing people together.
But can Mayor Eric Adams, who was speaking there on the show a couple of weeks ago, bring people together on his blueprint to end gun violence enough to implement the policies he's proposing and enough, frankly, to end gun violence? We're getting your comments and questions and those of our guests on the mayor's blueprint to end gun violence as we wrap up our listener reading project with your eyes on the 15-page blueprint. You can keep posting comments with the hashtag #ReadTheBlueprint or call in at 212-433 WNYC. Our guests are Antonin Pierre from Communities United for Police Reform, Richard Aborn from the Citizens Crime Commission, and Elise White from the Center for Court Innovation, and Tina in Central Harlem. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Morning, Brian. I'm a retired teacher, and I love the idea of these youth job programs. They can be really wonderful. I don't know how the mayor plans 100,000 paid internships for kids. That sounds like more of his wishful thinking to me. But if that was happening, wonderful. My niece was in a program a couple years ago, summer jobs, keep them out of trouble, keep them off the street. All they did is house teenagers in a school auditorium and pay them, when there are meaningful experiences that can be given to these young people, where they can contribute either in senior centers, in cleaning the parks, in doing all kinds of, meaningful contributive work. But warehousing them gives them just the opposite message that you want them to have.
It is if the summer youth employment program is experienced by them as warehousing, which you say it was for your niece. Let's take another caller also on the summer youth employment program and some of its shortfalls, I think. Monica in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monica.
Hi. I'm calling about my son who did apply for SYEP a couple of years ago and had a great summer job at the Department of Design and Construction. And the application for the SYEP was so arcane and difficult to follow that my husband, who has a graduate degree, had to take off work twice to go to offices and help my son apply for it. And I can't imagine a family where, somebody can't take off work and shepherd their child through it would succeed. And so I just hope that that's been rectified. I hope schools are shepherding kids through the process. It was very, very difficult.
Thank you very much. Jane in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane. Jane, are you there? All right. Deborah in Brooklyn, who read the blueprint. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired assistant commissioner from New York City Health Department, and I read the blueprint twice. I was extremely disappointed in the lack of metrics and the lack of community engagement, and side by side with that, hearing the mayor blaming, suggesting that bail reform is at the heart of the recent horrible murder in Chinatown. And I think what's lacking, if I could put my finger on the biggest thing, it's true community engagement and participation in the solution. And specifically, I'll mention we're very worried about the expansion of police in 30 precincts. What about an expansion of community-trained violence interrupters in those precincts, working with police, looking at solutions from community who are impacted? And no mention of training of police and dealing with the racism that we see that impacts who is brought in, who is accused. And finally, I'm concerned about the mayor's desire to give judges the ability, and he says this in the blueprint, to assess quote unquote dangerousness of someone when deciding whether to give bail. That is very frightening to me and calls, is known to choose bias and to penalize particularly black and brown people. And we should not be looking at this as a way to address our problems. So I hope that the mayor can look at this and look at there are no metrics in this and no budget, and the devil will be in the details on how much we're going to truly bring community to the solution.
Deborah, thank you so much for your call. I want to pick up on a few pieces of what Deborah brought up there. And Elise White from the Center for Court Innovation, let me go to you first, because what you do at the Center for Court Innovation, as you described earlier in the hour, is all data-driven. You do research and you come up with data, hopefully in support of solutions to gun violence and other problems. Do you agree that there's a lack of metrics in the blueprint to end gun violence in a way that troubles you?
I do agree that there does seem to be a lack of metrics. I mean, there seems to be a lack of details in general.
So I think the metrics is just kind of one piece of where there's some maybe vagueness.
What would you like to see
how
measured?
Exactly, these things would be implemented.
What would you like
well,
to see
I mean,
measured?
Well, I think that there are all sorts of things. Number one, I think it would be helpful to see some real documentation for why these specific initiatives are being targeted and what the specific outcomes are that the mayor expects to see affected. So that's thing number one, I think. Number two, I think it would be helpful. And again, I'm going to go back to my, the work that I do, which is that I think it would be helpful for us to see exactly, how they're breaking down and understanding, sort of conceptualizing gun use, because there does seem to be what to me seems like a false juxtaposition between trigger pullers and then victims. And here it does seem to read as though the victims are non-gun carrying, community members, which obviously that happens and it's tragic, absolutely. And these young people are both perpetrators and victims. And so I think, we're kind of focused here on SYEP, which is great. But to be looking, I think, as Anton has spoken to, and also Richard, these young people exist within networks, within communities, and within structures. And so how are we conceptualizing them, I guess, as the people that they are, rather than just the guns that they're carrying? That seems
to be largely the thing. And this comes back to what you said at the beginning of the hour, that your data suggests many or even most young people who carry guns in New York, including those who might be identified as gang members in many cases, do so for what they see as protection, not plans to be aggressive or criminal. So is there a central proposal from your group, the Center for Court Innovation, that discusses how gray that line is? That addresses it
with a policy,
an intervention?
I think a lot of the community work that we do is in place and has that gray line in mind. Basically, we want to engage all the young people that come through our doors, whether they are, whether they have a criminal court case or a family court case, or they are in the foster care system, or they're just, they're just kids in the community looking to be part of an after-school program, as young people who all need support, who need, have a vast array of needs and also a vast array of skills and things that they can contribute. And so we look to them as recipients of services, but also as drivers of change. Because
now,
we know that is something that they're interested in.
The other thing that the caller brought up was bail reform. And here we are 35 minutes into this conversation, and we haven't really mentioned bail reform, and we could spend the whole hour on it, which we won't, because that's all that the rest of the media seems to be doing. But Richard Aborn from the Citizens Crime Commission, on the specific question of the effects so far for the 2 years that bail reform has been in effect, and to the caller's interest in data, the supporters of the reform in place say the data refutes the arguments that it's increasing danger on the streets because, A, just 2% of the people released before trial are committing serious crimes during that period. State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins was citing that stat here on the show just yesterday. And, B, other cities that did not just implement bail reform are seeing as bad or worse increases in shootings as New York. So if those things are true, then why isn't all the pressure to jail more defendants based on perceived dangerousness just fake?
I think there are two levels to this inquiry. If one asks whether there's a direct correlation between, or even causation for that matter, between bail reform and increased crime on the streets, I think one would be hard-pressed to find data supporting that. But there's a second level of inquiry. And to the extent that we believe that deterrence impacts some of the offenders out there, certainly doesn't impact everybody, but it impacts some offenders, and I think the research pretty reliably shows that, then the lack of the issue of dangerousness, and I'll talk about that in a second, impacts that narrative. It says that we are lowering the potential penalties or the potential impacts from committing crime. So why do I say that? New York is the only state in the United States, including all of the federal courts, the federal system, that does not consider dangerousness in deciding whether or not a judge can set bail. To my way of thinking, this is not a place for New York exceptionalism. I think this is one piece of the bail reform package that we should change. I think everything else is by and large okay. I think some of the bail reform conversation should actually be about the discovery issues, which are in some ways more problematic but less known, but we can talk about that.
That's not enough time for prosecutors
to develop evidence.
Right. But if the data doesn't reflect the serious crime recidivism that the rhetoric suggests, then why does New York have to join the other 49 states?
Because crime in New York is particularly violent crime, shootings and murders, are skyrocketing, absolutely skyrocketing. The numbers are now staggering, far beyond where any of us thought we would be at this point. So we have to do things to change the narrative out there so that people understand there is going to be an immediate response to violent crime.
So
now, that's not something that's necessarily subject to metrics. That's a hard thing to measure. I completely acknowledge that. But people have measured the impact of deterrence theory. They have measured the impact of visible policing. And that research shows that both visible policing and overall deterrence, which we can talk about if you like, does have an impact on crime. It's not a solution. There are no single solutions in this space, but it is one of the things that helps us.
Antonin Pierre from Communities United for Police Reform, I imagine you'd like to respond to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when we look at what's been happening at the state level in terms of bail reform, there are a few things that we want to be aware of. I think one is that the bail reforms that were passed in 2019 were actually rolled back already in 2020. So any conversation that we're having about bail reform is actually regressive. We're talking about reforms that are actually going to take us to places that New York has never been in. I mean, as Rich has said, that we've never had a standard of dangerousness. And I don't think now is the time to stop. And another thing we want to think about is the fact that only 4% of those of folks who were released on bail in 2020 were rearrested for violent felonies, and only 1% were rearrested for crimes involving a gun. So we really have to ask ourselves, does having these regressive policies on bail and discovery, does this actually impact our public health in a way that makes sense? And I raise public health in particular because we know that incarceration is associated with so many different kinds of indicators of poor health, from depression to anxiety to sexually transmitted infections. And so the real question when we think about the solutions that are offered by the criminal legal system in general is what the system is offering us better for community health, better for family health, better for individual health than it is for punishment?
Here's a tweet that's coming in with a question. And the question is, what exactly do the mayor's gun teams do and not do? And Antonina, I'm going to stay with you on this for the first response. We know that one of the controversies in the blueprint is what the mayor calls neighborhood safety teams in the 30 precincts with the most shootings. And the mayor says they will be wearing modified uniforms, so they won't be plain clothes like the abusive units of the past. So how do you understand this idea of modified uniforms? And can that help make these units more effective at getting guns off the street while avoiding abusive and discriminatory policing?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that we'll see them wearing a lot of what we've seen Mayor Eric Adams wearing over the last month or so, which is, you know, plain clothes with some kind of insignia on it, which is still a version of plain clothes, right? And when we talk about what's going on in these neighborhoods, I mean, what has really gotten lost in this conversation is what, you know, these precincts that are going to be targeted, what are they, right? If we look at these precincts, we see that 32 of the 34 precincts are majority Black and Latinx. And so we've got this blueprint that the mayor speaks to public health, right? He says that gun violence is a public health problem. But, you know, thank you for asking so many New Yorkers to read the blueprint, because the first, the cover is police officers. It's an NYPD cover. It's called the blueprint. And so we're talking about supporting, quote unquote, supporting these precincts, supporting these neighborhoods. But what we actually see being offered is this policing. And when we talk about neighborhood safety, these neighborhood safety teams, one thing I want to note is that in 2021, the NYPD itself commissioned a study that showed that that people who live in these precincts, people who live in these neighborhoods, have the views that police do not treat people fairly, that police use force when it's not necessary, that their neighborhood is not a better place because of police, and that police do not address the problems of concern to their community. So if we really want to address what's happening in these neighborhoods, clearly policing is not the answer. And what we need to be looking at is the structural violence and the racial violence that's concentrated in these neighborhoods.
But the polls show that people in the neighborhoods you're talking about generally do not want less policing. They want better policing. Do you disagree?
I don't disagree. I mean, I think what we're talking about here is how neighborhoods understand safety, right? And so we've all been raised in this place where we're taught if something bad happens, you call a cop. And so we've all internalized the idea that being safe means calling police, even as we've lived in a place where we've seen and experienced aggressive policing, police violence, police murders of civilians. And so where we are, you know, particularly in this point, where this sort of mid-pandemic point is, we really need to be reconceptualizing safety and understanding that policing does negatively impact public health, that people experience, because of surveillance and police contacts, people experience anxiety and depression. And that if we actually want to create safety, we need to expand alternatives to policing. We need to expand acute violent prevention and intervention programs.
Richard Aborn, I'll go back to you on this, as I think a supporter of these modified uniform teams that are going to be entering the 30 highest shooting precincts. What do the modified uniforms do in terms of protecting citizens from police abuse that the old pure plain clothes did not?
Well, first of all, it lets people know that there are police present, which helps. But I think the more.
So why not wear a full blue NYPD uniform? What's the difference? Help me understand that.
Because the difference is these are undercover operations where they're trying to identify people who are carrying weapons and seize those people, get that illegal gun off the street. And you can't do that if you're in full uniform. New York and cities across the country have a long history with using undercover operations to identify and seize contraband. But I don't think the technique is so much called into question. It's whether or not these units are properly supervised. What hasn't been publicized is that New York has been using undercover operations throughout to seize illegal guns. In fact, the city has seized more illegal guns in the last 2 years than any other year in the past 10 or 15 years. The question is whether or not these units engage in the kind of conduct that led to the death of Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell. If that were to happen, whatever goodwill the mayor has built up will be gone in a flash. So I think the mayor has been crystal clear publicly, and I'm sure privately as well, that there has to be extraordinarily tight supervision over these units, that these units need to be very carefully trained and their conduct very carefully monitored. I think it's a prudent course, but it is one that could bring some real danger real quickly. So we need to be conscious of that.
Lisa, anything from you on that, from the Center for Court Innovation?
I think the only thing that I would add, because I think these are all pretty, you know, solid points that our data certainly supports, is that young people, it's just to hammer home this idea that these kids who are carrying guns already perceive themselves to be at war. And so strategies that increase that sense are going to lead to more gun carrying in the short term. And there's a, they're very clear that there's a direct correlation for them. And so I think the more police that are put on the street, it does increase significant risk for them.
We will continue in a minute.
May I offer one other point?
Go ahead, Richard, please.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt anybody. If I can just expand this conversation a bit and suggest this, there is no question in anybody's mind, certainly not in my mind, and I've been outspoken about this, that we need to engage in very serious police reform. The stories we're hearing about over-aggressiveness, sometimes violence, inappropriate behavior, et cetera, are well-documented and well-known, and you see it reflected in people's attitudes towards the cops. But we have a moment here where I think, in a way that I've not seen before, the community becoming involved in the effort to promote public safety and the police department increasingly aware of the reform, some of the reforms that they have to invoke in their behavior. And certainly the mayor is aware of this. I think this is the moment to have that kind of conversation about police reform while we are doing these things. That conversation does not need to wait. We're working on a concept with the University of Chicago that would convert this 19th century police force model we have into a police service model so that the police would actually be in more service to the community, including doing both intervention and prevention. I think those are the kind of conversations that we should be having now while we're carrying out these different sorts of police operations. It's really a ripe moment to do that.
We'll continue and finish up with our reading project of the Blueprint to End Gun Violence for Mayor Adams with our three guests and your calls and tweets right after this. The Blueprint cites 250,000, that number, young people who would be out of school and out of work. Do you have a number yet for how many the city will be able to afford to employ?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because you never hear people, when they talk about my plan, they don't talk about the preventive measures, because public safety is intervention, prevention, and we've outlined some real issues that we want to do that's really unique, and no one knows it better than a person that has gone through a life of looking for that summer youth employment.
Little exchange between me and the mayor from a couple of weeks ago, as we're getting your comments and questions and those of our guests on Mayor Adams' Blueprint to End Gun Violence, as we wrap up our listener reading project with your eyes on the 15-page blueprint. You can keep posting comments with the hashtag ReadTheBlueprint or call in at 212-433-WNYC. We have about another 10 minutes in the segment. Our guests are Antonin Pierre from Communities United for Police Reform, Richard Aborn from the Citizens Crime Commission, and Elise White from the Center for Court Innovation, and Jane in Manhattan, who we couldn't hear when we were trying to get you on the air before. I think now you're ready for us. Hi, Jane. You're on WNYC.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you, Brian. I always love the program. Thank you for the great job that you do. Good morning to your guests. I have not read that document Mayor Adams is talking about. I am seeing it and say, but I don't have access to all those things. And as far as I'm concerned, it's like, why would we have to go read hundreds of pages when it's his job to fully explain, break it down, is the exact plans that he has for us and the constituents. So he's like telling us to read it. Why? Oh, so don't bother me. Just go and read it for yourself. Don't bother me. That's what I'm getting. In terms of the 13, 14-year-old children with these weapons, I don't know where they're getting it from. When these people are caught up, they need to be sent to the big man's prison. That is where they belong, because they are trying to end other people's innocent children's lives, and innocent little children are being damaged. And the parents also must be found out and sent to prison as well, because it's called accountability. And I believe strongly 100% critical and detrimental punishment. That's what I believe. Because if that's not going to take place, then we will be in the same situation all of our lives.
Jane, thank
accountability.
You. Accountability. I hear you. Thank you very much for your call. Antonin from Communities United for Police Reform, not that everybody in New York would put it as starkly as Jane did, but when you look at the Quinnipiac poll that came out last week, black New Yorkers seem to be more in support of Mayor Adams' actions so far on crime in particular than any other group with a clear majority in support. So do you think people don't get it with respect to the positions that you have? Do you think there are more people like Jane out there than maybe the public conversation recognizes? Or how do you see that poll number with so much black support for Mayor Adams' policies on crime?
Absolutely. I think we really, again, need to go back to the neighborhoods that are experiencing the gun violence, these majority Black and Latinx neighborhoods. And what we're hearing, you know, the way that I interpret this poll is really that people, you know, it's hard. I live in Flatbush and you worry about gun violence. This is a real concern that people have. And what Jane was talking about, we've already done. You know, those of us who lived through a Giuliani, New York, a Bloomberg, New York, a de Blasio, New York, we've seen this kind of increased policing, and we've only, you know, what has come out of it has been a new generation, a new culture of gun violence that feels even more impenetrable than what we used to experience.
Although what they would say, those three mayors, is that gun violence went down and down and down and down with all those policies in place, and only now in the last 2 years during the pandemic has it popped up again.
Well, when you look at who's actually doing the gun violence, I really want to point to actually a report from the Center for Court Innovation that the people who are currently involved in gun violence, 88% of these folks have had a family member or a friend shot. So the nexus of all of this violence really is the systemic under-resourcing of communities. And even though we've seen a ton of policing, what we have not seen at the same scale is these communities being flooded with housing, jobs, education, and food security. What we're starting to see with the mayor's new budget is fiscally responsible policing, as opposed to actually bringing the resources that are going to undermine and uproot gun violence.
And so Elise White from the Center for Court Innovation, let me go back to you. And Antonin just cited you there. And I'm curious if you've looked yet at the mayor's first annual city budget proposal that just came out yesterday through a blueprint to end gun violence lens. Is he funding the various pieces of prevention as well as intervention in ways that say where he's willing to put his money where his mouth is and where he's not?
I have not had an opportunity to look at it. But what I will say is I completely agree with what Antonin just said. And what we heard over and over again from the young people we interviewed is, I was young, I was a kid, I was going to school, I was going about my life. Something happened to me that made me fear for my safety. And then I turned to gun carrying, or I turned to this, or I turned to that. And so and I will also add, actually, that historically, these programs, I mean, prevention programs are not funded anywhere near the rate of the intervention rates, especially when we get to this level of, you know, a crisis, because it is a crisis. It's a crisis for everybody involved, I think. So maybe I'll just leave my comment there.
Right. Okay. Well, to wrap up, are we missing the elephant in the room? The neighborhoods the mayor cites as having the large majority of shootings are just economically poorer than the rest of the city and have more Black and Latino residents. Therefore, the real root cause, we could say, is poverty born of longstanding systemic racism. The blueprint doesn't say that in that way. Should the blueprint to end gun violence be a blueprint to end chronic inequality and poverty? Is that the conversation or a conversation that we should be having? We'll go around the room on this and end here. Richard Aborn, is it a conversation the blueprint is having without quite putting it that way? The mayor does talk like that some of the time.
Of course, it's a conversation we have to have. This is a continuum. This is not a series of one choice or the other. We have to start with getting the gun violence down, but we have to engage in these much longer term conversations if we're going to reduce violence on a permanent basis. Brian, you made the point exactly that I was going to make, is we have success in driving gun violence down. We've been here before, unfortunately, and brought the numbers very low. We can do that again, and we now have the benefit of having learned from our mistakes in the past, so we can do it again without committing those mistakes. But if we stop there and don't have the conversation about the devastating lives that are led by a lot of folks in these very, very challenged neighborhoods,
then we're making a very big mistake. This is the moment to have that conversation, like it is around police reform. All these elements are starting to come together. So this is one of those crises that we can really turn into an opportunity. And let's not forget, when we talk about budgets, it's not just the city of New York that's putting money into prevention. The president's budget is giving lots of money to the city of New York for specifically violence interrupters and other community-based interventions. So I think the money issue is going to be fine. I think there are plenty of funds there for these programs.
Antonine, same question.
Absolutely. The blueprint completely ignores the racial and spatial violence that concentrates Black and Latinx folks in these neighborhoods low income. So if we take Brownsville and we compare it to the Upper East Side, what we see is an average household income in Brownsville of $30,000 versus on the Upper East Side, an average household income of $125,000. So when we're talking about this level of systemic inequity, to simply try to incise and just remove gun violence without addressing everything else, it does a disservice, and it really shows that this blueprint is not, as Mayor Adams says, about public health problems. It's not about public health solutions. It really is just about expanding the power of the NYPD.
And he certainly does call gun violence a public health problem in the blueprint. Elise White, you get the last word.
I think that when we're talking about lowering the number of gun crimes and gun violence, we have to remember that those have come at a great, great cost. And so when we're talking about the conversation this time around, I think framing it in terms of public safety and well-being is where we're going to see the most comprehensive array of responses that help all New Yorkers achieve lasting safety.
And so ends our reading project on Mayor Adams' Blueprint to End Gun Violence. We thank all of you who engaged as New Yorkers to read and comment and ask questions. And we thank our guests, Antonine Pierre from Communities United for Police Reform, Richard Aborn from the Citizens Crime Commission, and Elise White from the Center for Court Innovation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.